Welcome to You Don't Know Lit. I'm Nick Argyris, and this week I'm looking for a book about the great outdoors. To help me are my friends, quote-unquote friends, Ian and Joe, two English teachers.
I'm Joe Holshue. I'm a high school English teacher. And Nick, if you are looking for a book about the great outdoors, I would recommend A Walk in the Woods, Rediscovering America by Bill Bryson.
I'm Dr. Ian DeYoung. I'm a high school English quote-unquote teacher. And Nick, if you're looking for a book about the great outdoors, I think you should read Desert Solitaire, A Season in the Wilderness by the grouchy anarchist Edward Abbey.
May your earlobes turn into assholes and shit on your shoulders.
Hey, the plot doesn't fucking matter at all. This is what I think it's about.
If you look closely enough, every author was at some point a racist.
Audiobooks don't count, right?
All art is quite useless.
Who told you that?
Fun fact, that is how Joe laughs.
Every week you guys bring a book, and I keep an eye out for one-star reviews because I think sometimes they're funny. This book had so much shit talking about your author, Ian. It's unbelievable. Yes. People hate this guy on a personal level.
Yep. Yeah, I think to some extent with good reason. He was very much controversial. He's one of those controversial guys who likes to who's not afraid of controversy and in fact loves to stir the ant's nest. So he just poked people and perspectives, and it seems like he tried to alienate as many people as he could before he died.
This guy has reviews like somebody would, you know, on Curb Your Enthusiasm when everybody just calls him a bald asshole.
Yeah.
It's like that. This one-star review calls him a fat, lazy piece of crap.
Oh boy.
That's not the only one.
Interesting. I would apply all kinds of negative nomenclatures to Edward Abbey, but I wouldn't call him lazy.
Bryson. Bryson, yep. Comes off as a high and mighty asshole.
Yeah, right. So Bryson is the type of writer that book people love to hate on. Because
Joe's book.
Yeah, this is Joe's book.
Oh, no.
Yeah, Bryson.
That explains it.
Oh, oops.
I was going to say fat, lazy.
No. Yeah.
Sorry, everybody.
Yeah. Wait, hey, so you're talking shit about my book. I don't even know. Can you please talk shit about Ian's book for a second?
Give me one moment.
So wait, hold on. Joe, you were saying that like book people love to hate Bryson because he sounds what?
He sounds so Bill Bryson, and maybe I'll get into this later, but Bill Bryson was born in Iowa. And when he's about 20 years old, he moves to the UK and lives there for 90 years. And when you see
he's now 110 years old.
And then he wrote a book.
When he's 20 years old, he moves to the UK and lives there for 20 years. He marries his wife there. He has his family there. But he has, and some might say acquired, some might say affected British accent, and he's very charming and he's very likable and all these things, but he has this affected way of speaking. I don't want to say affected. Oh, no. That has negative connotations because I do think I don't think it's theater. I do think it's just something he's picked up over time, but he really does come across as a little bit elitist. And he says, he also has a way of saying a lot of negative things about the United States in his books. Like in the past, he's talked a lot of shit about America, and he really comes across
one of those elitist appellations.
Yeah. He really does come across as a bit elitist at times.
Interesting. It's really interesting you say that because Edward Abbey has also attracted a whole bunch of dislike and distaste, but the criticism skews in the other direction. He's too crude. He's too crass. He's like too unpolished. Yeah. So it's not like he's too snooty. It's he's not highbrow enough.
So every week you guys bring a book. This week we're doing nature. We got a couple show rules here. Only unavoidable spoilers. All right. Mm-hmm. Are you listening?
Yep. I'm writing them down.
Okay. Because that's important.
So you're saying only spoilers that are avoidable. Mm-hmm. Okay, good.
Only spoilers.
Only talk about spoilers.
Only spoil the book.
Omit unnecessary words, Joe.
Omit needless words.
And the final and most important rule, there's nothing more important than winning.
Oh, fantastic.
Oh, that's
winning
a good rule.
Equals everything.
I will say, after I lose, when I lose these when we record a podcast, one of these episodes, and I lose, it ruins my whole day. It ruins my whole week. I have a cactus in the back, and I just go, I scream abuse at that cactus because I got to let it out somehow.
I notice that after I lose, I don't think it affects my day or my mood very much, but I do notice that when I recommend episodes of the podcast for people to listen to, I almost never recommend one in which I lose.
Joseph, that is unethical. I want people to know that I win sometimes too.
I don't try to not recommend them. I just notice, I'm like, hey, you should do this one. It's really funny. And then I realize, like, no, I just won.
Listen, litheads, listeners thronging from around the world, I'll have you know that I only always recommend the best episodes, which aren't necessarily the ones I win. So I guess I'm just saying I'm more moral and I'm going to affect a British accent throughout the rest of this episode. Right,
fair enough.
So is lithead a joke on shithead?
No, never.
Couldn't be.
Never.
Just like that's not the joke in our title of our podcast. Yeah. The name of our podcast. It's just...
It does kind of seem offensive.
It seems like you're attacking
people.
Seems
like we might have attacked everybody.
I do think this podcast, if it does one thing consistently from week to week, which is very little, if it does one thing consistently from week to week, it is alienate new members of our audience. It's alienating further increasing sections.
Well, that's good. That makes sense because that's what literature does. Literature is all about alienating people, making people want to stop that's reading. Mm-hmm.
Joe, why don't you give us your 30-second plot here?
Yeah, I'm ready.
Your time starts now.
All right. A Walk in the Woods, written by Bill Bryson in 1997, is a book in which a travel writer decides to, even though he is woefully underqualified, attempt the 2,200-mile thru-hike of the Appalachian Trail. He researches, outfits himself, and, as the date approaches, gets super nervous about going solo and sends out invitations to anyone he can think of to join him. He gets one response, a long-lost friend who might be the only person less qualified to tackle the endeavor. The New York Times called it the funniest travel book ever written. Boom. How long did that take?
I forgot to call time on that one.
What?
I was going to say, did you practice that?
Yeah, thank you.
Was that 30 seconds? It seemed about like 30.
Yeah. Seemed about like 30. Yeah. So Nick, I have a question. When we were preparing for me to go, like you made us wait for a second. What were you doing?
I was getting my timer ready.
Which you never looked at again.
Well, then I started looking up the Appalachian Trail and got really distracted.
The ADD generation.
Yeah. Did you know the Appalachian Trail runs through several states?
14 states. 14.
Hey, Ian, are you ready?
So ready.
Go.
Desert Solitaire is a collection of first-person narratives about life on the Colorado River Plateau in the late 1950s. As shifts in American culture change the face of wilderness, these are stories as diverse as the murder of a uranium miner, the hunt for a wild horse in the canyonlands of eastern Utah, and a long, slow rafting trip down a river that no longer exists.
You have 5-8 seconds left. Do you want to do anything with that time?
I'm just going to sneeze.
Who should go first? I really want to hear about the Appalachian Trail, and who wouldn't want to start off with a little humor?
Yeah.
Yeah, so, Joe.
No.
Is this where Ian just starts?
No, I'm going to ask Joe, like, how are you going to back that funny thing up? Because as our faithful listeners know, we have failed to be able to accurately, like, we cannot communicate funny. We can't do it. It's really hard.
It is so hard to communicate funny. So all, yeah, and I think once again, I'm going to lean into our inability to describe funny on this podcast. And I have a couple quotes, but mostly you're just going to have to take my word for it and other people's
words. Is it funny or is it witty?
It's, I think it is laugh out loud funny. This book was adapted into a film starring Robert Redford, and Robert Redford's production company bought the rights to it. And he said the reason that he did it is because when it came across his desk, he's very involved in nature and conservation. And he thought
it was just another book about movies.
He's very involved in film. He thought it was just another book about nature, another book about conservation. And he said he knew he had to make it into a movie when he realized it had been years since he laughed out loud so often reading a book.
Hey, Joe, make us laugh.
Okay. I'm going to start by making you laugh with some fast facts about the Appalachian Trail. Not fun facts, fast facts.
Good. That's good. Those are even better.
we could play a game, because what I have in front of me is a bunch of numbers that are related to the Appalachian Trail, and you guys could guess what that number relates to.
Ooh, I will close the Wikipedia page.
All right. The first number is 2,200. 2,200.
Well, you already told us that one, so that's...
Okay, well, you're going to love my next one. 14.
Jesus.
It's going well.
That would 14 would be the length of the Appalachian Trail.
Yes, it is 14 states long.
Ah, dang. Okay. Give us some more numbers, Joe. This is a really fun game. It's going well.
All right, 6.
People who have died on the Appalachian Trail.
No, the number of people who died is much higher than 6. Oh. 6 is the amount of months that it takes to walk from either Georgia to Maine or Maine to Georgia for the average hiker.
Do you know how many people have died?
There have been 9 murders confirmed on the Appalachian Trail, and many other people have died of various things. Sometimes...
Bears.
Yeah, I started looking it up, and it got dark fast.
Yeah, so there's been 9 murders on the Appalachian Trail. Jesus. Various other people have died of things. The most common way of dying on the Appalachian Trail is losing the trail and getting lost in the wilderness.
6,643. What number is that, guys?
People who have died on the Appalachian Trail.
Ooh.
Yep.
Oh my gosh, are you serious?
No,
my
God. I'm not.
I was going to say, that's
Joe,
like
are you
going to
finish
town.
Your game?
10,000. 10,000.
10,000 even?
10,000 even.
The amount of time it took to form the Appalachian Trail.
Ooh. 10,000 is the amount of days, cumulative days, of volunteer service it takes to maintain the trail every year.
Holy cow.
Yeah, it is the largest volunteer endeavor on the planet. The largest collected volunteer endeavor on the planet.
Now, that makes sense because, like, it goes through a bunch of forests, right? And, like, not dry pine forests, but, like, wet hardwood forests where things are going to fall and trees are going to block the trail and there will be, like, mudslides and such.
Yeah, and almost all of those volunteer hours are devoted, like you're saying, Ian, to clearing the trail, to chopping up trees, to moving things off the trail, and to maintaining, like, signs and the blazes that mark the path.
Do you guys want a 1-star review on the Appalachian Trail?
Ooh, yes. Yes.
Okay, so I know we make jokes about 1-star reviews on this show, but I actually really love reviews on nature. So you can Google anything in nature and there will be reviews on it. There are reviews on the Rocky Mountains. There are reviews on Yellowstone. All right. Here's a 1-star review from Phoenix. Not the city, I don't think.
You think it's Joaquin Phoenix or River Phoenix?
Here's a 1-star review from River Phoenix. Very dark at night. Needs more streetlights. Also, Wi-Fi was terrible. I needed to watch True Blood and the bears stole my nut bars. Terrible. But the trail was a trail, so I guess it was all right. 1-star.
That seems like a bit of a joke. That's not
that does seem like a joke. Joaquin Phoenix is a notorious prankster. $5,500.
Teeth in a bear's mouth.
Number of reviews on the Appalachian Trail.
5,500 calories is how many calories you need to eat to maintain your body weight on the Appalachian Trail. That is 11 Big Macs a day and still in deficit. So if you eat 11 Big Macs, you will not have consumed enough calories.
Do they have like McDonald's where you can get Big Macs along the trail?
There are very few restaurants along the trail. It is mostly in the wilderness.
Well, how are you going to get your Big Macs, your 11 Big Macs a day, if you're not eating at a...
Five.
The number of people still listening to this episode.
5 is how many pairs of shoes you can expect to go through on the Appalachian Trail. Holy and God. 1948 is my final number, and that is the date that the first through hike of the Appalachian Trail was completed.
Joe, this is making me really not feel like I want to hike the Appalachian Trail, because if I can't watch my
Appalachian
True Blood and I can't get my Big Macs
and there's not a lot of Wi-Fi,
what's the point?
Yeah, so A Walk in the Woods is Bill Bryson taking on something relatively new in his life. Bryson, at the time he wrote this, was pretty famous in England as a travel writer. He had moved there. He wrote a book called Notes from a Small Island, in which he hiked around England. So Bryson moves back to America and he's looking for the next thing to write his book about. And he is by trade, I guess by trade, he's a journalist, but he's really kind of emerged as a travel writer. And when walking around his town in New Hampshire, he stumbles upon a footpath that is marked as an entrance to the Appalachian Trail. And it's something he's heard about before, but doesn't really know much about. And this idea of hiking the entirety of the trail, all 2,200 miles of it, just enters his mind and it grows there. And it soon enough totally captivates him. And he decides not only does he have to do it, but it's what his next book is going to be about. So he tells everyone. He tells his wife, who's not super enthusiastic about it. He tells his publisher, who is pretty enthusiastic about it. And he starts looking for people who will go on this trip with him.
So you mentioned him being a travel writer. And is this book nature writing? Is this book travel writing? Is he blending the two? Like, what's up as far as the genre of this book?
So, yeah, those are two good questions.
Thank you.
Thank you. You're welcome.
I'll write down some points for myself.
Travel writing is like when you start an Instagram account and you're like, oh, check out this lake. And now you're a travel writer.
Well, no, Bryson, it's kind of like that, but he has like worthwhile things to say about the places that he goes.
Are there pictures in this book?
There are no pictures on this book. There is a bear on the cover of it.
Oh, that's good.
There's a picture on the front.
There's a picture on the front.
So I guess this is a situation where you shouldn't judge a book by its cover. Because if you judge the book by its cover, you might say there's pictures in it. Because there's a picture in the front, but then you open it up.
Yes.
There's no pictures inside.
I got to wrap my head around that one.
Throughout his career, he would write all sorts of interesting books about travel, or interesting travel books. And a lot of them are traditional travel books like we think of. He's got a great book about visiting Australia. He has a book about living in England for the first time. But he also writes pretty extensively. And I'm going to call this travel writing because it's almost what it feels like when you read it. He has a book called A Short History of Nearly Everything, in which he writes about the history of science. And even though that is like, that's not a travel book. He's not going anywhere. It really does feel as if he is a tour guide through the history of science and these scientists' lives. And it's really this, I think, a genius that Bryson has to talk about things that are inaccessible from the outside and really dig in, find the interesting stuff, the most interesting stuff about it, and lay it out for his readers in this witty, comical, very breezy, very lighthearted way that he has.
Can you share some of those really interesting things? You've piqued my interest.
One of the things about traveling the Appalachian Trail is if you're just walking on this trail every day, and that's what it is, like they wake up, they break camp, and they walk, and they put miles behind them. If you're walking that, and that's what you do every single day, there's not that much to say about it. Right? Like not that much can happen. What did you do today? I walked 8 miles. I walked 12 miles. I walked 16 miles.
I found a dead body.
There's only really a handful of characters in this book as we would think of. It's Bryson. It's his friend Katz who comes with him.
So is this like a buddy film? Is this like a Lethal Weapon?
So it absolutely is a buddy comedy for the first half of this book. It is him and Katz kind of encountering the trail, both being totally unprepared for it. And really stumbling their way along. Katz is a pretty fun character. He's a pretty interesting character. He is overweight. He's a recovering alcoholic. That part isn't fun. But one of the reasons that he hikes the trail with Bryson is in order to help him with his sobriety. He wants to remove temptation from his life. And there are these moments of charm between the two of them that end up making Katz a very endearing character for us.
Hey, is this fiction?
No, it's entirely nonfiction. I should have probably said that earlier.
Yeah, definitely. So
is the bear on the front? Is that a character?
Yeah, it's nonfiction. Pay attention. Tell us about the bear, Joe.
He'll talk about at length about the dangers of the trail. And at one point, he talks about all the different things on the trail that could kill you. Rattlesnakes, water moccasins, copperheads, bobcats, bears, coyotes, wolves, wild boar, loony hillbillies, he says. And that's only to talk about animals and not the poison sumac, poison oak, poison salamanders. And he even talks about moose that gets this parasite in its brain that causes it to attack hapless hikers.
Wait, moose. That's got to be up by Maine, right? Like, you're not going to run into moose in Georgia, right?
I think possibly at the very, very northern stretches of the trail. Yeah. No, you will not run into moose in Georgia.
Good.
Hey, Joe.
Good.
Why is this? Yes. Why is this a good book to read if you're looking to the great outdoors? Was the theme? Why is this a good book to read?
Yeah, it seems like he hates nature and wants to be inside watching a TV show.
Yeah,
like True Blood. Like he wants to go inside and watch True Blood.
Or the remake of A Walk in the Woods with Robert Redford. So why is this a good book about the great outdoors? Besides the fact that it takes place in the great outdoors. Besides that part.
Bryson talks a lot in this book about this draw of nature that we all have, right? Like this idea that we're all drawn to nature at a certain point. And he talks about, you know, when you're on the Appalachian Trail in particular, not this isn't all nature, but when you're hiking on the Appalachian Trail, the only thing to do every day is put on miles, right? To put miles between you and your campsite. And he talks about like when you fall into this routine of just putting on miles, right? Putting on miles, putting on miles, putting on miles, your mind enters this meditative state. It's almost like this Zen state. And he says very frequently on the trail, he would think about nothing at all for miles and miles and miles. And it was almost like your brain was a balloon that kind of bobbed along behind you. And it was this incredibly immersive experience. And we talk about, you know, like right now, people are meditating for mental health. People are, you know, they look for this detachment from the busy world that they live in. And Bryson talks about the Appalachian Trail being not a crash course in it, but talks about the Appalachian Trail being this totally immersive experience that you can sink yourself into and leave the world behind. And that is one big value of the trail for Bryson.
Is that what the book shares with you, or is that what he felt? Because I feel like there's a difference.
I don't know how those two things are different.
Well, okay. Maybe let me sophisticate.
Ian, do a better, Ian, please, please help. Help me, Ian.
I'll use more words and it might be less clear. So does this book like make you share this feeling, or is it just like, here's a cool feeling I felt?
Oh, good job, Ian. Good job. Thank you. That's what I meant.
Yeah. Great question.
Thank you. I'm going to get some more points. I'm going to write down 30 more points for another good question.
I think translating that experience to a reader, like really, like just absolutely like bringing that experience to the reader would be, I think, an almost impossible undertaking. I think it would be incredibly, incredibly difficult to achieve that. Instead, Bryson promises that it's there. Uh-huh. And he promises so in a convincing way, in a way that I am sure if you go into the Appalachian Trail and you put these miles on every single day, I'm sure that it is this experience. He talks at one point that he talks about putting on miles just being the thing that they did, right? Like, and he says at the end of the day, you wouldn't say I did 16 miles today any more than you would say I took 8,000 breaths today, because it was just automatic. It was just like this natural thing that occupied you.
Kind of like we have to trust you when you say this book is funny. Bryson when Bryson
says
this.
Guys, it's so funny.
Suspended disbelief. Doesn't happen much in nonfiction, but he's managed it.
That's what nature writing is. Nature writing is a promise. It says like this thing, which you are having, which you're not experiencing firsthand, this thing exists and it's cool and it'll make you feel these big feels.
This is like a review on nature. It's a 5-star review on nature.
It is kind of a 5-star review on nature.
Is it a 5-star review?
Oh, it's absolutely a 5-star review.
Joe, what's your rating of this book?
I give this a 5-star. I give this 5 enthusiastic stars.
Hey, Joe.
Yes.
Does he like this though? Because he sounds like it's pretty miserable, honestly. Like he sounds like this guy he's with is a bit of a jackwagon.
Well, no, I disagree with that characterization. He absolutely likes this. It is tough. It's arduous. I think so there are times of trial, but he absolutely thinks that it's worth it and that this deprivation of the amenities that make our day-to-day life easy, right? That just depriving yourself of them is valuable in and of itself.
Hey, Joe.
Yes.
I have a question for you.
Yes.
I have a question for you.
Yep.
What is his sense of accomplishment when he finishes the trail?
I feel like this is a leading question because...
No, not at all. Tell us about the great joy he must have received from experiencing the great outdoors and taking in the full breadth of the Appalachian Trail, all 2,200 miles.
Oh, boy.
So, Ian, one of the things that Nick is hinting at here is Bill Bryson at maybe my favorite moment in this book. they are hiking and they start in Georgia and they're hiking north, right? They start in Georgia in the early spring and the idea is that you follow the good weather all the
right.
way to Maine.
Yeah, it makes sense.
They are hiking and hiking and they're having these troubles. They're encountering these dangers. At a certain point, their campsite is overrun with a couple of bear. And
the one on the cover.
It's like halfway through the book, right? And they go to a supply shop. So he finds this frame map of the Appalachian Trail on the wall that is 4 feet tall by about 3 inches wide. And he thinks, okay, I'm going to find where we are on this trail.
Hang on. How long have they been hiking by this point?
The book is 50% over at this point. Okay? Like it is the halfway point of this book.
So they must be halfway on the trail.
He starts on the top and he runs his finger down and runs his finger down and down and down and down and down. And he finds that they have hiked on this 4 foot map the first 2 inches.
Oh, no.
Yeah. So they get to this point and they go,
answer my question, Joe.
Are you shitting me? So at that point, they feel not a sense of dismay, but a sense of relief because they realize at that point that there's no way they're going to hike the entire trail.
Wow.
And they bail.
A regular Lewis and Clark.
They come back. What they do then is instead of attempting a through hike of the trail, they come back.
They go to McDonald's.
Well, actually, he meets his wife at a Burger King.
I don't know if that's a joke or not.
No, it's true. It really happens in the book.
Wait, he meets his wife at a Burger King and you didn't bring that up earlier when you're talking about McDonald's? No,
they rendezvous at a Burger King.
They rendezvous at a Burger King. Thank you.
So my eyes lock across the play place.
After seeing that they've walked 2 inches of the Appalachian Trail, they leave the trail. Bryson has to go on a book tour at this point. Stephen Katz has a job building houses in Iowa for the summer. And Bryson returns, and the second half of this book turns into kind of the greatest hits of the trail. So we see Bryson as he goes through and he section hikes the Smoky Mountains, Shenandoah, and as he and Katz and some other like notable landmarks. And at the end of this book, he and Katz return to the trail to Maine to hike the 100-mile wilderness, which is this kind of famously rocky, tough spot, but it's like the very last leg as you hike through the wilderness of Maine and climb Mount Katahdin, which is the spiritual finish of the trail.
I don't know anything you just said, but it's kind of bullshit that he writes about this trail and doesn't finish it, huh?
It's a really common criticism levied against this book, but I would argue that
Does he talk about it in the book? Does he address this or just ignore it?
Yeah, no, he does not ignore this by any means. Like, he talks about this feeling of relief that he has when it's these 2 inches on this 4 foot map, because he says, well, I realized that finishing the trail was never going to happen. So we were able to reinvent this trail and we were able to reinvent our journey and instead kind of make this into something that was still useful and still good for us. And I would say that even though Bryson doesn't finish the trail here, he has these takeaways that are no less authentic because he did not finish it.
Hey, Joe, at what point in his career did Bryson write this? Was this after he had kind of like gained a following?
When he writes this, he is well known in England and more or less unknown in the United States. Okay. Like you would have to be really kind of a book nerd to know Bryson in the US.
Interesting.
This book was a hit in the United States. It's probably like what made his name a little bit more of a household commodity in the United States, but would not be as big as later books that he would write.
So there's a habit that like when a writer gets fancy enough, like eventually they just go do stuff and then they can write about it. And if they write about it well, it's interesting. So like we see this with Mark Twain. Yeah. Mark Twain eventually is just like, here are some things that I saw in the mining camps. Here are some things I saw when I was on the river. And it's well enough written that we'll buy it. It's a someone whose voice we appreciate. It's someone who, you know, can have kind of crazy experiences and talk about them in an interesting way. And so like we're bought into it. So I wonder if like it's less about, you know, go hike the trail all the way through, or it's fine to not hike the trail all the way through, but more like, hey, do you want to see Bill Bryson hike the Appalachian Trail and see what he gets up to and read his shenanigans? Here we go.
He talks about, he has these moments where he, because when you're writing, when you, the only thing to talk about is walking, you have to bring in this ancillary information. You have to bring in this supplementary material. So he'll talk about the National Forest Service or the National Park Service or specific national parks, and he'll give them their own identities. And he has this section where he talks about the National Forest Service, and he says, a lot of people seeing the word forest in the title assume it has something to do with looking after trees. In fact, no, it doesn't. And then he goes on to eviscerate the National Forest Service as essentially this company that builds roads for privatized logging corporations. Wow. But when you read that, it's funny, it's engaging. It also like makes you mad, right? Like it's just this incredibly effective way of writing. He talks about the National Park Service at a certain point, like by name, they should be looking after parks, but he has this section where he talks about the biggest blunders of the National Park Service over the last 70 years, right? Including at one point trying to reclaim a riverbed for trout. So they dump like hundreds of gallons of poison into this river and kill all the fish there. I have it here. He says, in 1957, they decided to reclaim Abrams Creek, a tributary of the Little Tennessee River, for rainbow trout, even though rainbow trout had never been native to Abrams Creek. To that end, they dumped several drums of a poison called rotenone into 15 miles of creek. Within hours, tens of thousands of dead fish were floating on the surface like autumn leaves. Among the 31 species that were wiped out, one was called the Smoky Mad Tim, which scientists had never seen before and have never seen since. Thus, the Park Service biologist managed the wonderfully unusual accomplishment of discovering and eradicating in the same instant a new species of fish.
Oh my goodness, that's ridiculous.
And it is that he has this way of like looking at these moments that are just, it's hilarious and terrifying, right? Mm. Like all of these things. And his voice is strong enough, his character is strong enough that, you know, you'll read him. I would read Bill Bryson write about paint.
Hey, Joe.
Yeah.
Why should I read this book?
I think you should read A Walk in the Woods by Bill Bryson because it is a fun, engaging, funny read in which Bryson not only tells a story about like this buddy comedy of him and this and his unlikely friend as they attempt to hike this 2,200 mile walk through the wilderness, but in which you also are pulled in and you learn a tremendous amount about the Appalachian Trail, the Smokies, Shenandoah, the National Park Service, and all these kind of auxiliary aspects of the trail. It's fun to read. It's very funny. It would introduce you to Bill Bryson, who I would read anything he wrote.
Hey, Joe, you mentioned how funny this book is, like at least 2,200 times. But you haven't shared a single example of can you share a funny example from the book? Give us a taste.
Yeah. So this is a quick quote that I have from Bryson about when he's talking about black bears and his danger or his fear of black bears. And it's not, well, I think you'll get a sense for the type of humor I'm talking about here. He says, black bears rarely attack, but here's the thing. Sometimes they do. All bears are agile, cunning, and immensely strong, and they are always hungry. If they want to kill you and eat you, they can, and pretty much whenever they want. This doesn't happen often, but, and here's the absolutely salient point, once would be enough.
Hey, do you want me to start this teaser promo, guys?
Sure.
Yeah, please. Nick, you're a leader.
We're lost without you.
Hey guys, what's satire? How would you define that?
Snark?
Yeah.
Snark?
Like cutting, like something like undercutting? Maybe undercutting?
Poking fun.
Prodding.
Calling attention to the flaws in society or something.
Hypocrisies in society or ludicrous.
But it's not always like mean. Sometimes it's like just hilarious and like, yeah. Here's this thing that everyone loves. Guess what? It's also can be funny. There's like two kinds of satire, basically, is what I'm saying.
Wow, sounds like a real broad spectrum.
It is a spectrum, Nick.
It is. I would say it's a spectrum, yeah.
It's agreed, then. It's a spectrum. Do you have any books on the spectrum?
I've got a book on the spectrum. Nick, I actually do have a book. I have a book from one pretty far end of the satire spectrum, towards like the snarky, critical, reflective end. I would like to bring Slaughterhouse-Five by Kurt Vonnegut, in which Billy Pilgrim comes unstuck in time.
And I think I'm going to go to the other end of the spectrum. Big surprise. I'm going to bring a satirical adaptation of the Coen Brothers cult hit film, The Big Lebowski. This is a book called The Most Excellent Comedy and Tragical Romance of Two Gentlemen of Lebowski by Adam Bertacci. He was paid by the title word, so that's why it's so long. Wow. And it's very different, I think, from Slaughterhouse-Five. So
I that's another thing we're in agreement on, Nick. It is very different from Slaughterhouse-Five. Two different books.
Guess what? We're bringing two different books.
Cool, thank you.
Yeah.
Ian.
Yep.
Please tell us about your book.
So my book, Desert Solitaire, is about somebody who actually enjoys the great outdoors and who actually completes hikes.
Wow. Cool. So
that's got that going for him. Before I talk about this book, can I ask you guys what sort of sublime or sort of formative experiences, moments you've had in wilderness? Have you had sublime moments in wilderness?
Every time I camp, it rains. So, oh, okay.
Yeah, Nick, I've seen your pictures. You have. I know you have.
From the internet. Bryce, Inspiration Point at Bryson Canyon was the most beautiful thing I've ever seen.
Why?
I didn't know there was going to be follow-up questions.
just tell me a little bit about it.
Please. Okay. We woke up at like 4 in the morning to get there at sunrise, and it was in the middle of winter, so everything was frosted over. So we're driving there, and it's, you know, it's like purple out in the morning before the sun gets up, and so everything is shiny, and then you get there, and like the tops of the, are they like, what are they called?
Hoodoos.
The hoodoos.
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 Hoodoo, you do.
I'm sorry, what?
Nothing. Go ahead. The tops of the hoodoos.
The tops of the hoodoos are all covered with snow. So you had like green, white, and bright orange, and then the sunrise. It was really cool.
And how many people were like with you?
Who was around? Me and my wife, and then some strangers.
Okay, so there were strangers there.
Yes.
Okay. Interesting. Joe, tell me about some kind of sublime, awesome moment in the wilderness.
My most formative wilderness experience is a 10-day trip to the Boundary Waters that I did with, it was in high school. It was a class trip, essentially, but I don't want to make it sound like 300 students went. It was a class trip with like 10 kids.
Okay.
And in that trip to the Boundary Waters, we got to Quidico National Park. We were given essentially a crash course on this is how you paddle a canoe. And then the next day it was, get in your canoe. Here's a map and a guide. You're going to go out. And the entirety of the trip was we paddled out for 5 days, hiking, portaging, canoeing, building fires, camping, all those things. And after 5 days, we turned around and came back. And that was the trip.
That's so awesome. So thank you, guys. This is a really example of
that's I'd like everything to point out that this
Nick,
week.
Nick got two follow-up questions.
Well, no, you explained it pretty well.
Okay. Yeah.
You, I'm guessing, Joe.
Are
I
you
going to
use this information against this, Ian?
In a court of law, can and will be used against you. Joe, was it mostly when you were kind of canoeing up there, was it mostly just you and your group, or were there like other randos just kind of also canoeing past?
No, it was entirely me and a small group. And in fact, it was mostly me and the one guy I was sharing the canoe with.
Interesting. Okay. So this is really interesting that you guys have these kind of different, very memorable experiences. I think everyone has a different take on what is a good wilderness experience. And Edward Abbey, the reason I like this distribution is because Edward Abbey's book It has examples of both of these. So he has most of this book is set on the Colorado Plateau, Colorado River Plateau, which is kind of around the area where Bryce Canyon is. So he would have probably shared with you, Nick, some of the delight in the snow on the hoodoos and the bright colors, and though he would have liked it better if it had just been him by himself. And Joe, like, canoeing silently up and down a river is the focus of one of these, one of the chapters, one of the essays in this book. So Abby is not trying to in this book come up with a universal perspective on nature or travel or beauty. He's kind of saying, this is what I have, and if you, my reader, overlap with me, cool, good for you. But nobody's going to have the exact same perspective on nature and on the great outdoors that he, Abby, Edward Abbey, does.
Hey, Ian, tell us about this book.
So the book is these short nonfiction essays. The author, Edward Abbey, was a park ranger, and he also just kind of wandered in the American Southwest. Some of the book is focused on, like, nature, plants, animals, rocks. He has a whole chapter called Rocks, which is one of my favorite chapters in the whole book. Some of this kind of focuses on the complex relationships between humans and history and nature and resource use. So he's a ranger at Arches National Monument. Now it's Arches National Park. And so he talks about the campers that he has to deal with. And he has nothing but scorn for them because they're just so thoughtless. And they come in these huge, like, 1950s era automobiles that can't, like, go off road. They can't, like, drive through the washes. They are always getting stuck. And he has this wonderful phrase, which I keep, like, it sticks in my mind. He talks about the freshly bloomed white Kleenex flowers, which he picks after the campers leave. Oh. And this is where they've, you know, tossed their teepee or their Kleenex just out into the scrub. And he compares them to flowers, but it's obviously not. And so some of it is, like, people and nature. Some of it is just his own explorations. So at one point he climbs a mountain and then he slides down a glacier to get down. He rafts down this river that no longer exists. He hikes around the canyonlands and he finds a body. So he has some fun stuff that happens to him.
So this book is about meandering around nature for how many pages?
It's 269 pages, and it's not. No, it's based on his observations as a park ranger in 1957 and 1958.
Did you say he finds a body?
Yes. So he is camping and as a
good catch, Joe.
He gets called in. He gets called in to help with a manhunt. A tourist has gone missing. And so he hikes up into the Canyonlands area, and he looks around, and then he does help find the dried out corpse of a hiker who left his car and got lost and got turned around and died. And he has this whole reflection on, like, what a way it would be to die. What a great way to just kind of, like, if you have to die, why not sit down with your back to a pinyon pine tree and look out over the expanse of nature and understand, like, this happens to everyone, and I'm going out right here.
Uh-oh, did you secretly bring Into the Wild?
No, it's really interesting because Abby has these great reflections on death, but he loves life, and he's a very, like, vital person.
Oh, solitaire, because he's by himself.
Yes, he does not play. See, I opened up this book expecting it to be sort of like how you play solitaire in the desert.
Yeah.
Like, do you weight the cards down with rocks? How do you deal with sand?
The cards wind, get dried out. The sand.
Yeah. But actually, it's just because he's
bring a backup deck. There's so many problems.
I think you have to bring a backup deck.
I always bring a backup deck.
It sounds like one of the things he's talking about through here is absolutely, like, reveling, but also, like, in the case of being a park ranger, where even where nature isn't vanishing, right? We are still losing this natural space to maybe the tragedy of the commons you would talk about it as. And I think we've probably all had the experience of going to a national park or going to a beautiful monument or going to something, you know, that has been totally overrun by Instagram people. Right.
Yeah. I mean, okay. It is. Guys, let's talk about this. Okay. Let's talk about Havasu. Okay.
Let's talk about it.
Do you guys know about Havasu as an Instagram destination?
No, I don't know what Havasu is.
Okay, so this is a part of the Colorado River Canyon. It's right by the Grand Canyon. It's part of the Grand Canyon, and it's a place where There's just these beautiful, it's kind of desert all around. There's these beautiful waterfalls, green oasis, and it's the traditional home of the Havasupai Native American people. And so nowadays, if you want to go to Havasu, it is incredibly difficult because there's a limited number of permits. And the reason those permits are hard to get is because it has been taken over by Instagram influencers. And so if you want to do this, you either have to pay a ridiculous amount of money for a guided tour, or you have to hope and pray that you call, because you can't do it online, you call at the right time to get your to get your permit to go. And
how do you spell it? I want to put this on my bucket list.
H-A-V-A-S-U.
He has a phone call to make.
Now that it's like one of the places you go to be an influencer, you have to take your picture, your waterfall pic at Havasu.
Oh, I know this place. I know it from Instagram.
Exactly. You know it from Instagram.
It's incredibly like, okay, popular.
If you guys Google Big Sur, like the Google images are all the same because there is a specific place at Big Sur that you go and take your Instagram photos.
Hey, this is probably a good time for me to announce if anybody's interested in some original prints from Big Sur, you can head over to my Instagram account at Nick Argyris. That's at NickArGires. Thank you.
Perfect.
So Abby experiences Havasu kind of before it's this, you know, this
total fuck show.
it's a green screen for influencers to go to, and this is a kind of time traveling where we can go with him to experience this. And he talks about like he's the only person in the canyon, and he talks about how he's climbing around in the slot canyons and he gets lost, and he kind of like climbs down the wrong way and gets trapped in this sort of sandstone slide, and he's like, I'm gonna die here, I can't get out because I made a bad choice getting in. And so he has to like kind of jimmy his way back up the cliff face to climb out of this place where otherwise he'd be trapped. And none of this is possible today, because if you're down there, there's going to be so many helicopters doing flyover tours of the Grand Canyon. There's going to be so many people around there. It's going to be nonstop.
That's
so
a good thing. You made that sound like a bad thing. He could have died, Ian.
Yeah, but he's fine with that. That's
does he say
it goes
that?
Back to this thing.
Can you
it
read
goes
me
back
that
to this
quote?
Thing. He's a contrarian by nature. He's like, yeah, I've got to die somehow. I would rather die sort of in this place, surrounded by my memories, surrounded by the history of the Native Americans who lived here, by the ranchers who have worked here. I would rather die there than in a hospital bed. And he actually like made his buddies. He had a lot of buddies, kind of like hard drinking desert rats. He made them promise, if I end up like dying in a hospital, please check me out of the hospital, take me to the desert, and we'll drink me to death. And this did happen.
No,
he was dying of like internal bleeding from cirrhosis of the liver, and they were like, we're taking you out into the desert. And he was like, yes, here we go. And they buried him in a place where nobody knows where. And his gravestone reads, no comment.
Cirrhosis of the liver. Was he an alcoholic?
It does sound like it.
He does drink quite a bit.
Oh, so it's like the opposite of Joe's book.
Yeah, he lives pretty hard. Like he lives a pretty hard life here.
Yeah, right. And he dies fairly relatively young. A lot of these desert rats kind of they get like kind of preserved, and they live into they're hale and hearty into their 90s. But
now, would they like that term, or is that self-proclaimed?
Yeah, should we be bleeping this?
That's true.
What were the parks like in the 50s? Besides Instagram affecting it, I think we can get off the elitist Instagram train real quick. What were the parks like in the 50s?
Just completely completely unfamiliar to what we have now. So you wouldn't have like, you know, your park stores where you could pick up needful. You wouldn't have
McDonald's.
Paved roads to the campgrounds. Mm-hmm. You wouldn't have electricity at the campgrounds. You might not have running water at the campgrounds. You would have probably free firewood, which the on-site park ranger had cut himself from juniper earlier that day. Yep. So things have changed very, very much since then. The interstate system has been built. So in the 50s, it was just beginning, and since like it was finished in the 80s, largely. And over that time, more and more people began to be able to take these huge driving trips west. And so he is experiencing these national parks, national monuments right on the cusp of when folks are starting to engage. And some of the funniest stuff in this book is his interactions with kind of clueless folks, campers and hikers.
This book seems super polarizing.
Yeah. So Ian, the number one feeling that I have when you describe this is envy, right? Like when you describe this, I feel like I want to be at Big Sur before, you know, the Instagram spot. I want to be there. And I, yes. I get.
Is this a depressing book?
Yeah. Should I get jealous? Should I get envious when I read this?
Now I'm angry.
This is a book which is so well realized. It's so like the fact that this is so much about him, his perspective, and sort of him being alone in nature, it allows me to sort of like experience it vicariously through him. It's not the kind of thing that I experience. I see him and I'm like, oh, I could do that. I wish. It's different. It's a different time. It's past. It's gone. And I think he, because he's come to terms with it, he's not like saying, this is something which we need to save. This is something which we need to preserve. He's just saying, this is the way it was. And it's over. Let me read you a brief epigraph, from the beginning of a chapter.
What's an epigram?
It's a little italicized quote at the beginning of the chapter. That's that thing.
Okay.
This is the chapter called Episodes and Visions. It's where he kind of talks about sort of his ideas about the desert and the national park system.
I'm all ears.
Ranger, where is Archer's National Monument? I don't know, mister. But I can tell you where it was.
Ooh,
this idea that like these things are past. And I think he sees like the world changing, and he knows that really, as much as he might like to blow up dams and to keep, you know, progress with a capital P from happening, he knows he can't. Like he knows this is kind of past. He gives us what he has. It's really interesting. He wrote these notes. He had these experiences in 56 and 57. And then he just sort of like dinked around and wrote some novels, and they weren't very well received. And then in the late 60s, he kind of, these notes just lay fallow. In the late 60s, he returned to these notes and he punched them up into the book and published it in 68. And by 1968, more and more people are striking out west for vacations. They're doing this. He talks about this endless monotony of the road trip where you stop at the one-stop shop. You have the overheating radiator and the vapor lock. You have all the same things, the terrible food at the cafeterias. It's just the same things over and over. And he says, he's got this wonderful quote, a man on foot, on horseback, or on a bicycle will see more, feel more, enjoy more in 1 mile than the motorized tourists can in 100 miles.
I think a lot of us have a strange relationship with nature. And maybe it's in this country, maybe it's just like in the 21st century. I don't exactly know, but it so often feels like nature is a destination that we go to. We see that with Instagram. We see that with like traveling to the national parks of like, if you want to see nature, you get in the car, you drive out west, and you see nature.
You go to it, yes.
You go to nature. And one thing that I think our books have in common here is here it's not something that these guys travel to. It's something that they exist inside of.
Yeah. Let's take a brief step away.
Yep.
It's time for a Hobbit fact.
Oh, yes.
You guys maybe don't know this, but the Hobbit society is pretty pretty stratified in terms of class. So there are rich hobbits, there are poor hobbits, and there are middle class hobbits. Now, we all know Bilbo Baggins lives in a hobbit hole, but that's because he's well-to-do. It's only the rich hobbits and the really poor hobbits who live in hobbit holes. Most middle-class hobbits live in above-ground buildings. And that's been your hobbit fact for the day.
That's because he's a fucking thief.
Yeah, he is. He's a stealer. He's a thief.
Although you'd think if you were rich, you would probably build an above-ground house.
No, but if you're really poor, you just kind of like burrow one out. And if you're really rich, you can either inherit one from your family or like you can build one and it's very like well appointed.
Hey, Ian.
Yeah.
Do you have any stories about the FBI?
Edward Abbey was an anarchist. He espoused anarchist beliefs. And in college, he did, he published, he was an editor for a literary magazine, and he was encouraging people to burn their draft cards. This is in the 40s, late 40s. And so the FBI opened a file on him, and they kept a file open on him kind of ever since his college days. So he was not really
Did he hate everybody? It seems like he hates everybody. Seems like this guy drank in the desert until he killed himself.
he had a lot of, so for one thing, he was
alone.
What you call a serial monogamist. He had a lot of relationships. He loved hanging out with the ladies.
He didn't hate everybody. He loved the lady.
And also, he has these kind of like weird like friendships with men where he's like hangs out with them and travels with them, but he also kind of like talks trash about them a little bit. He kind of it's gentle ribbing, but he's like, this guy has these like silly habits, but I still like rode down a river with him. This guy is you know, this guy is annoying in these particular ways, but I still climbed down into a maze of canyons with him. So he's not a misanthropist. He's not like just hermit out in the desert, but he doesn't like there was a lot of, I mean, I think maybe more structures. He doesn't like structures. He has a whole chapter. He really doesn't like the national park system. He has a whole chapter about how bad it is, where he claims in this chapter.
Why?
Among other things. Well, he thinks that national parks like make wilderness too soft and too accessible. And I read that quote earlier about how you can see more if you walk a mile than if you drive 100 miles. But he kind of takes this to an extreme, and he says, among other things, national parks should not make accommodations for people with disabilities. So like, if you have a disability, tough, you should have.
Maybe nature isn't for you.
yes. Literally. He says, like, you should not have, you should have gone before you were disabled.
Jesus. Does he say that?
More or less. Like, not those exact words, but like the idea is very clearly there. He's like, if old people can't walk 20 miles or ride a horse 50 miles into the backcountry to see these beautiful things, maybe they should have gone earlier. And he says the same thing for kids. He says, like, if kids can't walk, you know, they can't hike up a mountain, you shouldn't put a parking lot halfway up the mountain. You should wait until they're older, and then they'll be able to climb it. So he has this kind of narrow, yeah.
It's, you know, kind of for an anarchist, he sure has a lot of rules.
Go ahead.
That really hasn't aged well. You know, in the world that we live in, that hasn't aged well. But,
brilliant, Joe. Brilliant. But like,
well, but there's a logic to it, right? Like, when you look at it, you go like, well, I don't know. He's not wrong.
It depends on what your priority.
Well, he's kind of wrong.
he's saying, he
Joe,
has
why don't
idea.
I break your legs and see if you agree?
No parks for you. He has no this parks idea. For Joe. He has this idea that like wilderness is something which should be absolutely like, people shouldn't make roads into it. He calls national parks national parking lots. He really doesn't like how the car can just drive you right up to the edge of Niagara Falls or whatever. He really doesn't like that idea. He says, like, if there's wilderness, there should be a boundary at the edge where you park your car and then you walk or cycle or ride your horse in, and that's it. So like, it is consistent, but I think personally, I'm not super down with that. I mean, as I get older,
are you condoning this,
Ian? I'm not. My body is falling apart. I am becoming old and gray and wizened, and eventually I will very much take advantage of those handicapped parking spots or, you know, the paved trails where people who can't really hike that well can go. So
I do think there's something for the argument that nature is something that deserves to be met on its own terms.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, when we look at like the stuff, maybe it's extreme sports, you know, when we think of like whitewater rafting, like where people are going down extreme rapids, or when we think of people doing survival backpacking in the country, that is admirable. Like, that's really admirable of just like a man versus nature on nature's terms and coming out unscathed or maybe slightly scathed. I don't know. I understand why that argument hasn't aged well, but a part of it appeals to me. A piece of that argument appeals to me.
There's a difficult balance, and we talked about this with Instagram and Havasu. There's a difficult balance between access and accessibility on the one hand, and sort of like pollution or too much access. And I think, so like, there is such a thing as too many people in wilderness. I think maybe Abby goes too far the other way. I think definitely he goes too far the other way, but I think this is an interesting conversation to have. Like, what is too much?
Yeah, this guy's got some demons. that's okay, though. Yep. So besides his super polarizing views on nature, Ian, why is this a book worth reading?
A few things. The voice, his voice is really, really unique. He blends.
Is it like a deep baritone?
It's cracked and dried by the desert wind. He blends humor and pathos and adventure and philosophy and nature descriptions all into this mishmash where like he can take this pivot from really beautiful poetic language to kind of extremely straightforward, almost Hemingway-esque simplicity in like a paragraph. So this voice is one that I haven't really encountered this kind of approach to nature writing anywhere else. A lot of times nature writing tends to be lyrical. And he does lyrical bits, but he's also really funny. Also, here's another one, which I think speaks to our conversations about access. So he's talking about this area of the American Southwest, the Colorado Plateau, which is the plateau through which the Colorado River runs. This place is kind of hard to get to, and it's more difficult to get into, to like get to know this area. And reading this book lets you get into the Colorado Plateau area. It's a book that makes you realize your smallness, like how small you are, and then it shows you how to cope with that, which is cool. I think a lot of times it's a classic move for books to say, hey, man, aren't we so tiny in this huge universe? Full stop. But Abby takes us a step further and says, well, how do we feel about this? What do we do with it? And then I would say the last reason is this. Okay, so the Greek philosopher Heraclitus said, all things move and nothing remains still, and you cannot step twice into the same stream. And Desert Solitaire, especially the end where he's leaving Arches National Monument, it displays this beautifully. Like, when I come back to this place, I may not be the same. It will not be the same. And this is kind of a sad thing, but this book also gives it a touch of hopefulness as well. Maybe there'll be things I recognize. Maybe I'll be different for the better. Maybe this place, against all hope, will be different for the better.
Hey, Ian, congratulations. I would love to read your book. Can you finish this with a quote here?
Sure. This is the end of the
book. Actually, more than saying, here's another polarizing thing. Rather than saying who wins, I really like saying who loses. Joe, you lost. Ouch. Ian, can you read us a quote?
okay. Yes, I can. This is the very end of the book. This is the part which
do
I
do we need always, a spoiler warning?
No.
Spoilers. The park. Spoiler.
Spoiler. Winter comes and he can't stay at Arches all winter. So, he is leaving, and here's how the book ends and his sojourn in his season in the wilderness ends. No end of blessings from heaven and earth, as we climb up out of the Moab Valley and reach the high tableland stretching northward. Traces of snow flying across the road. The sun emerges clear of the overcast, burning free from the very edge of the horizon. For a few minutes, the whole region, from the canyon of the Colorado to the Book Cliffs, crag, mesa, turret, dome, canyon wall, plain, swale, and dune, glows with a vivid amber light against the darkness on the east. At the same time, I see a mountain peak rising clear of the clouds, old Tukanikavats, as fierce as the Matterhorn, snowy as Everest, invincible. Ferris, stop this car. Let's go back. But he only steps harder on the gas. No, he says, you've got a train to catch. He sees me craning my neck to stare backward. Don't worry, he adds. It'll all still be here next spring. The sun goes down. I face the road again. We light up our after-dinner cigars, keeping the flame alive. The car races forward through a world dissolving into snow and night. Yes, I agree. That's a good thought, and it better be so, or there might be trouble. The desert will still be here in the spring. Then comes another thought. When I return, will it be the same? Will I be the same? Will anything ever be quite the same again? If I return.